Welcome to Navigating the Spectrum with Michelle Portlock. I'm your host, Michelle Portlock, and I'm so happy that you joined me today. I'd like to introduce you to Dr. Julie Falmini McBride. Julie is the Director of Research and Development and co-founder at the Steadfast Institute. Julie has overseen the implementation of research focus and development specifically designed to better understand and meet the needs of women, men, LGBT identities, and those with intellectual and mental health impairments, such as autism, OCD, bipolar, depression, ADHD, and other conditions who experience problematic pornography use. Today, I wanted to discuss specifically sexuality and disability with Julie, and I'm so grateful that she joined me today. So thank you, Julie, for being on the podcast today. I'm so excited to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So, Julie, I want to jump right in and ask, what led you down this path, particularly the path of disability and sexuality?
Kind of a long story, and there's so many different roads leading to this one section. But as far as it goes for the topics that we're going to cover, the interesting intersection here is that my PhD is actually in disability studies and education. And I ended up doing my dissertation on women's pornography use and really looking at the intersections between disability, sexuality disabling, marginalized groups like women, and those with intellectual differences, and autism emerged as a group of people with disabilities that have really interesting intersections with sexuality related issues. And so it just became an area of importance and interest because of a lot of the issues that we face as a society today.
I really like that. I like that you have jumped right in, and I know that you have done your own research, published research, and I just have found so much of what you've shared so interesting. And I want to ask you, how is teaching healthy sexuality any different for a member of the disability community or a person with a disability as opposed to a typically developing individual? And is it different?
Yeah, well, one thing that isn't different is that everybody needs a really good comprehensive sexuality education. But it is different teaching it to people with disabilities. And depending on the type of disability, the approach would be slightly different. But if we're looking at an intellectual difference, such as autism, it's pretty different. People with autism already struggle with identity formation in general. They're usually developmentally delayed in certain areas, especially socially. And there's a lot of issues that arise, especially with sexuality. We know that autism is a social and language disorder, and disorder is not really the best word to put for this. I would say difference. But when you're delayed socially and have difficulty really analyzing how to conduct yourself in social situations, that creates a lot of issues when it comes to sexuality, not just sexuality, like how to interact within sexuality, how to internalize those interactions, anywhere from topics related to consent, engagement, even the types of pornography that people on the spectrum view are different than the types of pornography people that are neurotypical view, that also really combine together to create some challenges for people on the spectrum. But there's also issues when it comes to identity formations with sexual orientation and gender identity as well, that people on the spectrum, not always, but more times than not, have variances in those areas. And so the way you teach sexuality education to people on the spectrum is really different because you're putting emphases in areas that you wouldn't for someone that's neurotypical. You're breaking down certain steps that most people pick up on, but someone on the spectrum needs really broken down because that's social incongruence and the communication incongruence.
Do you have any specific programs? I haven't seen that there are specific programs created out there for individuals that are autistic or have other disabilities. Is this something that you have just kind of adapted for your clients that are, that may be autistic?
Yeah. So at the Steadfast Institute, we definitely have very niche specific types of ways we do programming with people on the spectrum. Mm-hmm. Part of what makes our programs for porn recovery unique is that we're not just looking at like eliminating porn use, but looking at the nuances for people with different intellectual variances mm-hmm. and how it impacts them. And so we definitely integrate a lot of very autism specific components for people on the spectrum. Mm-hmm. As well as other developmental variances in mental health conditions like OCD or ADHD. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we handle it very differently. And I don't know of anywhere that does do that. A lot of times you'll go to even like a sex therapist or someone that works just with autism therapy, but they don't know how to integrate the two. You'll go to a sex therapist that might totally normalize certain behaviors with people on the spectrum, you know, attributing them to being, you know, something that's very normal, or maybe it's just their orientation or identity or preferences, and not really fully realizing how people on the spectrum are different and the different types of direction they need for stability. And so people really struggle with that. And it's really sad because people on the spectrum will go to therapists that are generalists with either sex therapy or other areas that mm-hmm. don't really fully understand autism. And even if they do have a psychology degree and they understand the diagnosis of autism, what to look for in the DSM, they don't usually understand like the complexities and nuances with the whole system when it comes to the IEP process and early identification and so on. And so it's unfortunately a really sad situation for people on the spectrum because they're either getting someone focusing specifically on autism and like eliminating unwanted behaviors or focusing on it from like a more clinical, just like, you know, like platonic society interaction mm-hmm. social basis mm-hmm. or you go to someone that's like, you know, trying to specialize in sex therapy but then not understanding the nuances with autism. And so there's really not a lot out there for people with autism, and it's really sad. And we're seeing it trickle down, you know, even at the more extreme levels. You know, we have disability incarcerated, we have more people on the spectrum that are, you know, incarcerated or at risk for being incarcerated because of some of these complex issues, when we're really not fully addressing and understanding the complexities of autism and sexuality.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm just condensing and what you've said, because it makes perfect sense to me. I feel like essentially what you're saying is there are a lot of professionals that think of autism in a clinical perspective, but have a very challenging time or don't know how to translate it into the real world and what this actually means for an autistic individual. And I just, you know, it kind of made me think about my own daughter. And when she was in high school, she's autistic. She's 21 now. And she had a boy in one of her classes that has a disability himself. It's a different disability than hers. And he grabbed her rear end and she slapped him. And she, the person that was working with this child, this other child, not my daughter, actually had this child apologize to my daughter. And I was very nervous because I thought, well, how does this work out? What do we do with this? And when I was talking to my daughter, she said, "Mom, no one has taught him boundaries. He doesn't know appropriate boundaries." And she said, "My instinct if I'm touched inappropriately would be to slap someone. So look out, world," because she's a slapper. But the truth of it is there were boundaries that he needed to be taught that he wasn't taught yet. And even though he has a disability, he can be taught those boundaries. I kind of wish it wouldn't have gone down that way, but it was kind of a lesson to me because I thought, okay, she has now learned what her boundaries are. And she's trying to uphold her boundaries. And she said, "He'll never do that again to anyone." anyway, I look at that situation and I think there are things that were missing. This boy, there were things that had been missed in teaching him appropriate boundaries and guidelines. And I wish it had been taught differently to him than besides my daughter slapping him, but he did. It did work out okay, and they still ended up having a friendship later, but there had to be a lesson for her and a lesson for him. And I just think sometimes it doesn't translate, and sometimes we think we've taught that, those skills and those lessons, but maybe they haven't been fully taught or appropriately taught according to the needs of that specific individual.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's people on the spectrum that they don't fully understand consent. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about like the Me Too movement, and we talk about consent as a society, mm-hmm. we're often like looking at it like that. It's just like, everyone's like this sociopath that just like, you know, invades people's spaces in these ways, and they're malicious. And I don't undermine victim stories, because you do get a lot of those. You mm-hmm. do get a lot of people that don't care about boundaries. They mm-hmm. they find stimulation off of breaking people's boundaries. Mm-hmm. And these people are the ones that need to be convicted. These are the people that need much more punitive, harsher punishments. Mm-hmm. But the hard part is people with autism, a lot of times can get confused with people that are more on that narcissism, sociopathic spectrum, mm-hmm. Because they might display behaviors that look like it, like mm-hmm. violating boundaries or mm-hmm. persisting on like something they find to be like correct or important, and not listening to anyone around them, something like that, right? And mm-hmm. so that's something we think automatically narcissism, sociopathy, like, you know, but someone on the spectrum, they might be displaying in that way or presenting in that way, but mm-hmm. people on the spectrum, it's known that in the autistic community, the people on the spectrum are actually like very, very hyper focused on doing what is quote right. Yes. And they have like some pretty rigid beliefs and boundaries about being correct and doing the right thing. And usually they're really just trying their best. And the boundary issues are a result of not getting the proper education. So for your example, like that's something that can be seen for sure. And they'll feel very awful. Mm-hmm. They'll feel really awful because they didn't know something was wrong, or they, you know, for example, they might've seen something in a movie mm-hmm. where someone did something like that, but then it was perceived well. And so they thought that they could do that and it would turn out well for them, because yes. they're very singular focused. Mm-hmm. And so it's very confusing and upsetting to them, especially if they think they hurt someone. And so they're doubly beating themselves up. Like, how did I not know that? And whoa, I did something wrong, and I didn't want to do something wrong. You know, whereas someone that's more like narcissistic, they know, they just like the reaction and they hope they can get away with it. Someone with autism, they're not trying to get away with anything. They're usually honest to a fault. Mm-hmm. And it would be very upsetting for them. You know, one example too of this is, you know, people on the autism spectrum are developmental, not all, but a lot of them are developmentally delayed, and a lot of them feel like a child inside, especially if they haven't had different supports to help them develop in different areas. And what we see with autism in the research, as it relates to pornography, that's really interesting, is that you have people on the autism spectrum that at higher levels than typically developing peers are viewing pornography that's illegal with minors in it, children or maybe on the teen mm-hmm. ages. And what's really interesting is they'll get convicted if they are found to possess such materials in the same way that someone, you know, that's really malicious having those materials on their computers. But the difference is that people with autism are usually not acting on it. It's the people that are more on the narcissism spectrum that are acting on it. But people on the autism spectrum aren't. And it's really sad, because when we talk about like the sex education, you know, we have this movement in society that's trying to say, oh, porn is fine. Masturbation is fine. All these things are totally fine. And then if you don't agree with that sentiment, you're like too far right. But what they're not seeing is this is really a disability disparity. Pornography affects people with disabilities in very significant ways. And a lot of the people with the biggest issues with pornography have some kind of mental or intellectual difference. And when it comes to autism, like I said, the type of content people on the spectrum might view, whether it's illegal types of pornography, or even if you're looking at like things like bestiality or depicting like animals, things like that, these are not, you are not looking at villains here. You're looking at people on the spectrum that didn't receive support. You're looking at people that might have been bullied in high school and can't fathom the idea of ever connecting with a human being. And so they're viewing like different types of pornography that, you know, might not depict humans. And I am not condoning that. Absolutely. It's wrong. It's not okay. But I think the problem we're seeing here is that these children were not getting the right supports, and they're finding themselves in the situation where they're looking at these types of pornography and not acting on it, usually in these cases with autism, but they feel horrible because they know it's not societally accepted, but they don't have the same like wiring to kind of compartmentalize that or not engage in it. And they're really swept up into this whole group of people that are more malicious, people that are more narcissistic, or people that are, quote, devious. But that's not people on the spectrum. And so that's something really important to understand when it comes to sexuality with people on the spectrum. And again, we don't excuse it, you know, like your daughter's friend, it doesn't mean what he did was okay, or there shouldn't be some kind of consequences. But we do have to understand how differently we have to approach teaching sexuality matters to people on the spectrum, and the different types of grace we might have if someone is found guilty of something and the interventions that might be offered.
I do want to ask you, how can we better accommodate neurodivergent individuals or autistic individuals when they are learning about what healthy sexuality is?
Yeah, this is really tough because someone on the spectrum requires a lot of interventions and early intervention. And so we talk about maybe what we might teach as far as sexual education does differ, and that part is crucial, important, and we have to approach it in a specific way. But it really also melds into the other areas of need, you know, when it comes to occupational therapy. Like if you have a young child on the spectrum that's been identified, there's different sensory needs that need to be met, right? And a lot of times you'll see compulsive masturbation in autistic populations, and they're not having sensory needs met. And, you know, and again, we have this issue in society where we want to normalize things like porn or masturbation, and we're really marginalizing a huge proportion of our population, because we know that it's like, I believe it's like 1 in 6 people have autism. And that's just what we know now, right? It could be higher. And so we're not addressing like a large percentage of our population, their unique needs. And when we talk so generally about these matters of sexuality, and like I said, there's areas of communications when it comes to speech and communication. When kids are getting early intervention with speech, like talking about intimacy, talking about feelings, talking about their identities, that's something that needs to be taught through speech, occupational therapy, having sensory needs met. There's a lot of things with sexuality and sensorial that need to be addressed. There's so many areas that an IEP might address for someone on the spectrum that really should incorporate this social emotional communication, which also involves sexuality and intimacy. And it can start at a young age. And so it's complex. I couldn't map it all out now. Like if I couldn't sit down with you and tell you every little piece, but I can tell you more generally like what needs to happen. And like I said, it's a disability disparity. We're really marginalizing these kids. We see in autistic populations, we see not the majority, but like over half of the autistic population we're seeing in numbers now you know, identify with LGBTQIA issues. And interestingly, they don't identify as quickly or persistently as someone that really truly identifies with those identities. Yet we're accepting that this is very common and normal for a population on the spectrum that's also dealing with issues related to just social accessibility and job access, occupational access. And so it's a really big concern because everyone deserves to like really understand who they are. And people on the spectrum, they have issues with identity formation. They usually, from a very young age, feel like they don't belong. And so there's just so many issues, not just when it comes to masturbation or pornography, but when it comes to like their sex identities, their gender identities, sexual orientation, relationship orientation. This is a source of great confusion for people on the spectrum. And so it's really important early on to help them with their identity formation. And we have a social media movement now that's a good thing. We're becoming very accepting of people from different populations, marginalized populations. And that's a really, really important thing we're doing as a society. But again, we're marginalizing people that have disabilities, people on the spectrum, rather than taking a very inclusive approach where we talk about those differences, we lump them in with another category. And we've been doing this time and time again for people with disabilities, and the outcomes are not good. We know people on the spectrum deal with some very sad disparities when it comes to isolation and relationship formation. And that's not a good thing. And so addressing these issues across all the areas of need is very, very important from an early age for people on the spectrum.
Mm-hmm. What you're saying is making me think about just my own children. And I was thinking, you know, there's a struggle with reading body language in other people and understanding what might be manipulative behavior versus honest behavior. And I think when we talk about like sexuality, that's a big deal. It's not a small thing. I think that as far as like manipulation is involved, I have, you know, my oldest daughter would take you at face value. If you said something, she'd say, okay, you know, and she has learned a lot over the years. And I think that for me, one of the skills that I have developed is really reading body language. But I look at my kids and it's when I saw that they maybe don't or can't. But I do think that my kids are now better at reading a room. But I guess I'm looking at if they're in a relationship with someone. And I could see that it would be easier for them to be manipulated in a way that would be inappropriate. And I think that's a tricky thing to teach, that just because someone says it doesn't mean that's either number one, true, or number two, that they even meant it. There can be, yes. And that's actually kind of scary to me as a parent. It feels a little scary. And we've talked about that with our kids, but it's when your child is experiencing that in a relationship, it's kind of a different ballgame. Yes. And you hope that there's open communication so you can talk them through that. But that's not always the case.
Well, this is the tough thing about what you're saying, is that, and this is what a lot of people don't understand about autism. Mm-hmm. And this is a really tough fact to swallow. People on the autism spectrum, since the time they are very little, they feel different. Mm-hmm. That is a core part of how they feel. They feel disconnected. Mm-hmm. And they just don't feel like they belong. Mm-hmm. And so people on the spectrum are always going to be looking for places of belonging throughout their life. And we do have people that prey on that. We have people that give them a place of belonging, but it's not a genuine, authentic, or good place, or it's misguided. They give them a place of belonging that doesn't actually align with who these people are. But when they feel that sense of belonging, because they have trouble with identifying these social cues and really understanding the nuances of personalities, they want to feel accepted and like they belong. And so they have a really tough time with that. And that can override some of the judgment for a lot of people on the spectrum, which again, another disability disparity. People on the autism spectrum all have their own ways of creating schemas. And once they create these schemas or patterns of rules by which they operate, they're really loyal to those schemas, because for them, being loyal or rigid to those schemas is goodness. It's being a good person. And they're so loyal to that quest to be good people. And it can get, the schemas can get wired the wrong way sometimes if they don't have the right support and direction. You know, anyone that has a child on the spectrum knows, I have a kid that's really rigid about this one thing. He has to have this certain type of noodle. And if he doesn't have it, we have meltdowns for hours, you know, and the schemas develop. And sometimes, like, they're really hard to break. The time loops, the rigidity. And we see this with stuff when it comes to social interactions and heightened anxiety, some of these identity issues. It's really complex. We don't even fully understand it in the research world. And so it's just it's really sad to see the disability disparity and just how people on the spectrum, a large proportion of our population, is just being marginalized and not receiving the support they need to understand these really important pieces of how belonging, acceptance, feeling okay with themselves interplays with all these social issues and sexuality. And so I think the most important thing to teach a child on the spectrum at the very core is that they're always going to feel disconnected. That's going to be something that's going to be very hard to fill the void for, if not impossible. So they're going to need to carry that burden and understand that that's a feeling they're going to have to live with and not try to fill it by trying to fit in certain groups or go with certain people. They need to separate that void and making decisions off of that void and trying to fill it with a different map or schema they create about values and really having a good support system to check in about some of these decisions, right? And that's just the reality for people on the spectrum. And that's an issue they come into too if they get married. You know, I never feel understood by my partner. Maybe there's someone else for me. Maybe I should cheat on my partner, things like that. But someone on the spectrum just needs to understand, hey, if you're on the spectrum, you're always going to feel like someone doesn't fully understand you. That's a part of the condition. And so they have to find a way and receive support to really find value in who they are and that part of their identity. That part of having autism means that there is that disconnection because they're not able to pay attention to all the social issues. And we can teach them the best we can, but we have to help them learn to live with that and be okay with that because they run into a lot of issues not understanding that piece.
I think that is a really powerful message that you just shared there. And I am hoping that parents are taking note, because I will tell you that my daughter wasn't diagnosed until she was 14. And we didn't I was unaware of what to look for as far as autism goes. That wasn't even on my radar. I didn't know for a long time. And then before I started studying about what I was seeing in her, the more I started kind of leaning into, I think this is autism. Maybe we should go get some testing. We had done all kinds of testing before, but there wasn't a professional that caught that. She, for a variety of reasons that I won't even dive into now, but I think had I better understood that, and we definitely have a values-based home, that our kids know what our value system is, and we teach it and we guide them in what our value system is. I think every family actually has one, whether they have stated that or not, unstated or stated. They just, sometimes you need to sit back and say, well, what is my value system? What am I teaching unintentionally that is important to me? Or what am I, and then decide how to make that an intentional value that you're teaching in your home. But I think what I would have loved to teach my daughter is exactly what you said. You are going to feel this way. It's a reality. That's the reality. You will feel different and unique and maybe a little socially awkward. Let's embrace that and just acknowledge that is how you're going to feel. Sometimes I think we say, we try to push away what feels uncomfortable, but I liked your thought on essentially acknowledging and embracing that, that it is, this is what is, and it exists within you. And let's just accept that that's part of your experience. And then I liked the thought that you shared of not trying to fill in any gap, because it's not that there's a gap for them necessarily. It's that they're going to feel this and it's something they'll just carry with them. I have ADHD and I have felt socially awkward in many situations on many different occasions. And for me, I've turned it into humor, which I know isn't this, not everybody's going to do that or wants to do that. But that's how I have managed it for myself. I've had a lot of awkward social interactions that I think that was hilarious. What just happened? But I don't think it feels funny to everyone, but I'm just saying, I really like the way you talked about that. And I really like the way that you acknowledge it and just say, it is, it's the reality. It exists. Let's talk about that. Let's acknowledge it within our kids. And we don't have to try to fill that in.
Yeah. And it's, if a child has the type of home you describe, that is ideal. Having a home or a community that says, hey, you don't need to go search for identity. Like, we understand you being on the spectrum, like, means that you're gonna have a hard time identifying with people in general. You belong, and we're gonna save this space of belonging for you no matter what. You don't need an identity to belong here that feels like it makes you feel more intimate, right? People on the spectrum, they just need us to create places of safety for them. They need to be able to know that I can belong here, even if it's socially awkward for me, that I can go be alone. I can take the time out to be awkward or be whatever I am, but I'll always have a place of safety. And so people on the spectrum, they're looking for places of safety. And sometimes different communities say they offer that for them. And so they want to identify with that. But people on the spectrum have a different way of identity formation than neurotypical people do. And that can be really dangerous because if they're seeking identity validation from places where they feel like they belong, that's not really their identity, right? They're just trying to feel like they belong and that feels good. And then they identify with that good feeling. And so it gets really tricky for people on the spectrum and even more tricky if they don't know they're on the spectrum. And like you said, with your daughter not knowing until she was 14, that is unfortunately really common for girls. The disability disparity for girls on the spectrum is crushing. Girls are commonly overlooked for autism because they present differently. They mirror typical behaviors much more fluidly than a male does. And they're commonly overlooked and is really, really, really sad. And so we have to be able to, as a society, get to a place where we're so disability inclusive that we can notice that people have variances and differences and realize what they need. But obviously that's something we can't get to as a society overnight. But you know, your podcast and the work we do, it's a step closer to hopefully getting to that place.
I dream of that. I have another question for you. And for listeners, this is a specific question and maybe kind of hard to talk about or listen to, but I think it's really important to touch on it. My daughter actually sent me a study and it was on sexual violence regarding autistic women. And the study found that 9 out of 10 autistic women are victims of sexual assault, with 50% aged 15 or under when first attacked. This is kind of triggering information to some, but to put this into perspective, research also shows that about 30% of the general population have experienced sexual violence. So I want to touch on the two percentage differences because I think it's important to recognize that there is that disparity that you talk about. But what do you think might be related to these extremely high percentages of sexual violence among autistic women? And how, second part, how can we better support autistic girls and women?
Yeah. So it's interesting, the stats that you quoted, because it just depends on what study you're looking at and whether it was nationally representative or not, and what considerations they took into account. So true. But But the nationally representative samples that are most recent currently available actually show that over 80% of women in general have been sexually assaulted in some way in their lifetime. And as far as, as far as girls on the spectrum, that number would likely be higher. And we know that it's higher, but as far as a nationally representative sample, I'm not sure if I'm not aware of any nationally representative autistic sample, but it's possible it's out there. But I know from some of the smaller studies that girls on the spectrum are more susceptible to sexual violence, like you said. And it's a really big issue. And when we talk about in the autism community, you know, and this is, you know, your daughter made a good point about boundaries. She learned about boundaries, but it's interesting. A girl on the spectrum, she might have learned about very specific boundaries, but not about other boundaries and not known how to integrate them. It's really interesting with girls on the spectrum because girls are already at risk for being sexually violated. We have different ways that we've socialized girls to be more passive or to be more okay, or the way we've socialized boys to feel like maybe this is okay. And then we have complexities with porn. If someone's looking at porn, what they may perceive to be socially acceptable or not, or arousing. And so there's so many complexities with that. But girls on the spectrum, they're dealing with some of these identity issues. They're waiting to better understand like who they are, what they like, what they don't like, what they feel is wrong. And sexuality, again, it's a social interaction, a social interaction that's supposed to be between one other person, ideally. But this is a social interaction and the schemas are not going to be the same. And they're going to be tricky for girls on the spectrum. What is appropriate? Oh, you know, like where do boundaries begin? Where do they end? When we talk about sexual assault, we look very black and white. Oh, did someone just come up behind them and just attack them? But that's not what in most cases sexual assault looks like. Right. You know, usually sexual assault happens in increments. You know, maybe you're talking to someone at a bar or in a situation, and then maybe you are attracted to them and you hug them or you kiss them, but then you didn't want it to go so far. And there's a lot of really gray areas with when it comes to consent. And someone on the spectrum, if neurotypical people and girls already have a hard time with that and the female socialization about sexual interactions, a girl on the spectrum is going to have an even more difficult time with that. And then at the same time, you know, if someone really is a predator and they know how to find people that don't have those strong boundaries or understanding of those situations and put them in those situations, you know? And so when we have a girl on the spectrum, this is key, you know, first and foremost, how do we protect their safety? Yes, we want to talk about healthy sexuality and what that looks like. And that can be part of the conversation, but first and foremost, how do we keep these girls on the spectrum safe from harm in these situations, you know? And that's a really tricky balance. But as parents, hopefully they have good parents that can talk to them. We have to really break down every step to them, show them examples. Girls on the spectrum will often watch movies and they'll take just from movies, not even pornography, they'll take those situations and mirror them and think that that's how things are supposed to be. You know, you even talked about your daughter slapping the guy back. That's like a really common thing that's picked up from the media, you know, and that's something too, where in another situation, we would say, hey, you know, that might've been a reaction, maybe self-defense, but when someone's on the spectrum, it might've not necessarily been like that fluid. It might've been an automatic reaction from something they've picked up from the media. Maybe she didn't know she even had an alternative to use her voice and say, hey, I'm not okay with that. Do you understand what you just did? Or maybe they didn't know that they could go report it to the police or go, you know, like, or the nuances of the situation. Maybe they thought that was their only option. And so we have to really break down the options in different situations and the nuances. And even you'll see with someone on the spectrum, as you break down options, those are also going to be really hard to myelinate. And so you have to repeatedly discuss, communicate, have role play situations, social stories where you go through these scenarios. Like, okay, say you're in this setting and this happens. Like, what options do you have? And help them understand that they don't just have A or B, that they have like 20 different options and go through those options. And it's exhaustive. Explaining things to someone on the spectrum, you are going into the depths of areas that you don't have to explain to most people. And so it's a lot of time and effort and continual line of communication with someone on the spectrum.
I 100% agree. I have spent most of my parenting years breaking information down into smaller, more digestible parts, and then going back to those. Sometimes you think you've got it. Like, I think I did that. But then other issues may arise within what you felt you taught, because you may just see it or experience it differently than your child. And so I think for us in our home, it looks like being open to questions at all times and not judging your child for the questions that they're asking, keeping that open line of communication there and available to your child, and showing up without judgment, because it does allow your child to ask some of those harder questions that if we're shutting them down, they're definitely not coming to ask us those things. So
exactly.
Mm-hmm. We have worked so hard at that in our house. And I always tell people, I'm like, hey, we say things and talk about things that you might not hear other places. And it might be a little unnerving, but we have to. That is the way we talk here, because it benefits our children that need things broken down that way in order to fully process what is going on in their mind. And, and so I think that's been a really valuable tool that sometimes can be overlooked. So I'm so glad that you mentioned that. I think that for parents listening, they'll appreciate that you shared that as well. I do want to ask you one more question. I'm sure that listeners are saying, wow, Julie, she knows what she's talking about. How do I follow her so that I can learn how to better support myself or my children or a loved one in these ways? How can they find you?
Yeah, sure. You could find me on Instagram at Dr. Frau Mani McBride, or you could follow the Steadfast Institute on Instagram, or if you go to our website, you can always reach out with any questions. And just circling back to what you just said, like what you just described, that non-judgmental space, that's the place of safety I'm talking about. That's the place of belonging and safety. Like, you belong here and you can ask any question and you can be weird here. You could be whatever you need to be here. Don't worry about it, you know? And like, that's, everyone needs that. But people on the autism spectrum, for them, if they don't have that, it is far more detrimental than to a neurotypical person, because if they don't have a place of safety, their anxiety heightens and they won't know how to operate in social settings. They need somewhere where they can land safely to figure out the social stuff. And if they don't have that, it will make life impossible for them.
You shared the most powerful lesson right there. And I know it from personal experience, because in the early years, thought we raise our kids this particular way. This is how they're raised. This is how we teach them to be good people. This is how, and I was trying to do those things and it was not working for my child. And I could see it through their behaviors, but I didn't understand at that time how much our children, particularly our autistic children, use behavior as a form of communication. I just thought I haven't done a good enough job teaching them that skill set or that life lesson or that value. Or I constantly took it back to me failing to teach that properly. And so I kept going back to it. And in time I learned, hey, if it's not working, then I need to change my approach. And I also need to look at my audience and better learn. And they were my children, but I use audience because I'm saying I need to look at them and say, you know what? There's clearly a disconnect in the way that I'm communicating this, and they have a need that's not being met. And how am I not meeting that need? And once I learned that, particularly my daughter was autistic, I was able to deep dive into the world of autism and what that means and could look like for her. And she was able to find her community and we learned it together. I wish it hadn't been through so many of my own mistakes, but it was. And I decided to try to have compassion on who I was then and really lean into what I've learned and where I have moved and shifted to now that is so much more beneficial and supportive of my child and my children and who they are.
I love that. And, you know, parents with kids on the spectrum, spouses with spouses on the spectrum, that's mm-hmm. just a reality that the people that love someone with autism have to accept. Mm-hmm. You know, they can't take the behavior of someone on the spectrum as like this insult to them. Mm-hmm. They can't internalize it as like this lack of love or the withdrawal and things like that. They have to learn that this is part of the operations and they can communicate their feelings and say, hey, this is not typically acceptable. But sometimes people on the spectrum, they can't. Mm-hmm. They can't not stim. They can't not withdraw. They can't not be silent. And so that's another important part of education for people that love someone on the spectrum so that it can help maintain a good relationship. So I love the way you describe that. And that's an important thing for people to understand.
Well, I appreciate that. And I really appreciate you joining me on the podcast today. Is there anything that you think that we might have missed that you are in your mind saying, I really want to share this last piece?
Yeah, I think I tried to weave in as much as I could, but I think the biggest takeaway message that I hope people will have is to be really weary of social movements, generalized messages, and think that we can apply those to people on the spectrum. I think we have to understand people on the spectrum and what that means and what that comes with. And we have to be very direct with people on the spectrum, give them very concrete examples, roadmaps. Yes. We have to be very direct with them. We can't do this loosey language. We need to give an abundance of safety and acceptance for them, but mm-hmm. also give them that strong sense of boundaries. They need more of that concrete. That's how they develop best. And we live in a world that wants to feed abstract to everyone. And we have to understand people on the spectrum, like young children, they go from concrete to abstract, but people on the spectrum go much slower from concrete to abstract. And so throughout their life, they need concrete weaved in with just about everything. The abstract doesn't work for people on the spectrum. And so as we're going on in society, advancing in a lot of different ways, I fear that we are hurting our people on the spectrum at large proportions because we have not considered the need to give very concrete guidance for people on the spectrum. We've become so accepting in our society of what a relationship should look like, of what sexuality should look like, that we're really leaving people on the spectrum not just out to dry, but out to hang themselves. And I don't like that metaphor necessarily, but I want to emphasize just how impactful it is. Mm. People on the spectrum need us to be concrete with them. Mm-hmm. We try so hard to teach them all these nuances, but it's the concrete way of teaching with the nuances that they really need to thrive. And we're doing our people with autism a great disservice right now. And I think that's the biggest message takeaway I would want anyone to take when it comes to any of this stuff is just like, they need more from us, not just acceptance under any circumstances. They need a place of safety to discuss complex topics and learn, but also have structure and guidance in that process.
I am a visual thinker. And so when you say the word concrete, I'm thinking of an individual standing on cement, concrete. It's not going anywhere. It's stable. It's they know exactly where they stand and where to put their footing because something stable has been created underneath them. And that's kind of the image that's coming into my mind. I love that you chose to use that word. And I just want to thank you again, Dr. Julie Framini. Actually, let me say that again, Dr. Julie Framini McBride. So thank you so much for your time, for your wisdom, for sharing your hard-earned knowledge. I just really appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much, Michelle. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this with you.
My pleasure. For listeners, you can also follow me on Instagram at navigating.the.spectrum. Thanks again.